Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Sally Rosen Kindred. Sally Rosen Kindred is the author of No Eden, a new book of poems from May Apple Press, just published in 2011. She's a graduate of Duke and Duquesne Universities. Her awards include the Anna Biosis Press Chapbook Prize and fellowships from the Virginia Center for Creative Arts and the Maryland State Arts Council. For information on Rosen Kindred's work, go to noeden.com. Hi, Sally. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here. I know that you live in Maryland.
And, yes.
And so we're glad that you could make the trip. So you're going to start with some poems from your new book, No Eden.
That's right. And I'm going to start by reading the first poem in the book, which is a babysitter poem. It's called Prayer for Mrs. Sneed. Out of thorn apple, out of love apple, out of bramble fruit like green ice, comes the heaven I wish for Mrs. Sneed, who held me in the hard work breath of Greensboro mills till I'd sleep, who brought the washcloth to my feet the way cats rake tongues across their young. The stunted apple out back was her first gift, yearning and torn. Days I was sick, but grandmother was sicker, and my mother was in Orangeburg to tend her. Mrs. Sneed's parlor spun me in its holy apple glass, its stained lamp finches in gold ice. Her rough breath rubbed me with the alien dust of girlhood in the mills. She'd left these same bricks, cold mornings, 60 years back, as the train churned by outside. Back home each night, I missed her tired Jesus, and the apple tree refused to answer light with the snow flowers my mother said would come. Christmas brought the music box that gave me Mary holding him. Angels turned around them bearing harps. On Mrs. Sneed's last day, that is almost what I saw. Heaven, her body at its center, holding me, holding any of us close. And all around, her Ashley, James, and Fitz, reaching in under drifts of blooms, playing not harps or flutes, but scratched windows of fruit, God as green, delicious, as her hands had always been. The next poem I'm going to read is another outside in North Carolina poem. It's called Twilight, 1974. This is when it goes wrong. The green hose dropped at the lily bed, dripping on hot grass, and my mother's pastel body headed always for the porch screen door. Never mind the long-haired neighbor girls kicking their tanned legs on the drive, their father's red Nova crawling toward the fresh carport paint. Now it's over. Now nothing can stop the plodding seizure of the gray porch rocker and the gold beer asleep in the glass. Now she's wrapped in some darkening mesh, her own season, and I am dangling out on a warped swing, child of stooped dogwoods and lilies that sing and never leave their beds. Now summer must get dark. But here's when, across the screen at her feet, blue faces appear out of time. The 4 o'clocks open hours late into night, pushing their silk cheeks up against June and tipping their sudden hearts toward the sky. The next poem I'm going to read is also from the book No Eden. There's sort of two landscapes in the book that tend to merge. One is this backyard in North Carolina, and the other is a more biblical landscape. And they're sort of two kinds of poems, and they started coming together. So this is one of the Noah's Ark poems, and there are several of those. Something to note in the poem, in the Talmud, there was a story of Noah being afraid that it would be too dark once the rain began. He wouldn't be able to find his way. And God instructed him to build lanterns out of garnets, and which he did, as Noah tended to do because he was told, not knowing how that would help. And when the rains began, the garnets were lit from within, and that's how he found his way. This poem uses that story but makes it a little darker. and it's called Animal Dark. 1. There is no sleep in the ark. Noah brings garnets for light, but they shrink from shining, sunk into daub and sweat. They rattle when black winds shake the boat's wood bones. His people remember sleep. They remember when God's hand cut night from day in a dry world of reeds and burnt sand. Now mole rats worry at the floorboards and dark garnets stutter on the wood. The cattle sleep, but the people know better. They know you can't see thunder. They know the water took away summer, took the fig trees, the cisterns, took feet from warm grass, and dry garnets won't leak blood light. 2. This is no story for children. Even the scarlet lampstones can't fix it. This is a world swollen with loss, the bloat and rot of bodies bumping the ark all night like dumb fruit. Inside, there must be something intended, something God wanted from the grief, the crooked brays, the dark scars of garnets, and the living bodies turning against sleep. Somewhere to the left of this story, there's a moment where everyone's inside, everyone's saved, and it's enough to be alive in the warm animal dark, alive in the journey through wreckage and writ. But back at the center, there's just a family awake through a storm. There are fists of wind hammering walls. There are adders in the straw.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Sally Rosen Kindred, and she's reading from her new book, No Eden. First of all, congratulations on your book.
Thank you. It's pretty exciting.
It just came out.
Yes, it's new but old. It took a while to get here, so it was quite a process.
Well, could you tell us a little bit about that? Because I know there are other writers out there who are in that process.
Well, anybody who worries that they've been working at a book for a year or two and it's taking too long can have hope, because it took about a decade. Mm-hmm. And really started with the poems about childhood. And then there became this moment when I took off with these Noah's Ark poems, and then another moment where I realized there were intersections and that there were these moments coming together, and I was interested in one because I was interested in the other. And it just took several years to work all that out. So really, writing the poems in this book, it was about 6 years, and then, you know, a little more to get it out there in the world. So,
right. I mean, that seems right. I mean, it takes a while to write a book.
Yes.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I don't think anyone can write a good book in 2 years, except maybe some genius people.
Right. Well, maybe they can come on the radio and tell you how to do it. I've got no idea.
I wanted to mention, you know, what a strong sense of narrative you have, and it seems to create some kind of warmth in your poems, you know, with all these full body details. I mean, it's sort of comforting to listen to, regardless of, you know, there's a lot of conflict and
right,
you know, and primal activity going on in your poems. I also really like the way that you use detail because, for example, in your poem Twilight 1974, you had this great line, the plodding seizure of the gray porch rocker, and, you know, great sounds there. Mm-hmm. But I like how those details echoed later in the poem with, you know, the use of the word stoop, and then, you know, which sort of recalls an idea of porch, and then the use of the word tipping, which tipping hearts towards sky, which sort of recalls the motion of the rocker. So, I mean, you know, it seems, you know, so well crafted. Can you talk about that?
Thank you. I don't know if I can or not. I think part of the project you were talking about, you know, this sort of balance between what's dark and what's kind of lulling and warm. I think part of the project was to try and, you know, re-enter some of the terrors of childhood and these childhood stories we're told, like of Noah's Ark, but with some empathy and those sort of, you know, childhood can be, for many of us, a very intense period and a real sensory period. It's a real kind of assault of the senses. And so in kind of getting inside that I guess a question I'm asking is, you know, how does it physically feel? So I guess I'm looking for kind of a visceral experience. And so if I catch on to a kind of motion, then I build on that. That may be kind of the seed.
How does what physically feel?
How does the experience of being in that backyard at that moment, that moment when it goes wrong? That's the first line. This is when it goes wrong. Mm-hmm. So I may start with this sense, this sort of sense memory of when it went wrong, and then try and work physically into what it was like to be there. Mm-hmm. And I guess if I capture some kind of motion like the tipping, then I build on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was wondering if you were going to read the poem Orangeburg. Is that the title?
Oh, is it Flight, about the drive down to Orangeburg?
Maybe that was it.
Or No Eden, which has – well, no, that has Branchville County in it. I'm not sure. I don't have Flight with me.
Oh, okay.
Which is about the drive down to Orangeburg.
No, that's
I'm
okay.
Sorry.
That's okay. You know, read what you want. I mean, things are going well here. You have some wonderful poems in that book. So why don't you just read some more?
Okay. All right. Well, the next poem I had up is a poem called Apple Night. So that's another of these sort of outside poems, and begins with the names of actual apples that grow in North Carolina. And you could just make a poem of just the names. I mean, it's, you know, that's it writes itself. And ends, too, with the name of an apple, and that may not be obvious. Ginger Gold is a kind of North Carolina apple. Apple Night. Green delicious, yellow delicious, gold rush, Bentley sweet. I don't know what I've come for over the black barbed wire between my yard and the Rumseys. It's September. I've been at the swing until I forgot my mother and father heading down the drive to walk, and only her blue body coming back. I forgot everything but the setting green, moss beneath the sweet gum, the ragged, bright braids flung out like honey, and the smoother faces twilight folds sea gray. Now I am standing in Dusty's father's orchard, lifting the hem of my shirt to cradle four tart moons, their skin divided from mine by black cotton. My feet bristle into grass, scratched bells. I covet this dusk. I'm not hungry for apples. My legs steam where their skin lifts in hooks and stars from the fence's blood promise. I don't think about getting home. I am going to be here until my body turns the silver wet of the orchard's breath, until my bones are flares of ginger gold. The next poem I was going to read is actually not in the book, but it seems to kind of overlap with it's part of a new manuscript, but it's got a little bit of that that end of days Noah's Ark feeling and that terror of childhood, so it seemed to fit. This one is called When They Painted My Room Yellow. At five, I feared a city of sunflowers. I feared their appetites, their fevers and sleeps. I feared those gold blooms pushing over the levees and crowding the crumbling lanes. I feared the population explosion, masses of ratcheting petals, their singe of joys blistering into ruin. I knew I could not feed them. I feared sunflower Armageddon, stems dragging their hungry disks, piling their dead in brown-veined tents, ray flowers and seed flowers hurling themselves into traffic. I feared them tunneling into my ribs and charging through my bones. They wanted me for the sun. They flooded asphalt and air, choking off my dark breath, my own cold season. Now I want to bleed their towers and streets. I want to be the heat spirals that shower their centers with wet teeth. I want to live in that hive, fold my body into all their golden angles. I want to pull those wild throngs to my lips and say, the name of my survival is sunflower, as if I knew myself gold, a feast of grief ribbons. The next poem I'm going to read gets back to the Noah story. I think as kids we're all taught about the dove that comes back with the olive leaves in its mouth to show Noah that they've arrived at land. And what I didn't remember when I went back to start writing about Noah's Ark was that first he throws out a raven, and in one version, two, and they don't come back. So this poem is called The Raven's Wife. You are the bird that does not come back. Your wife waits at the prow's wet edge for the cold flood of this world to recede, for the winds to split and reveal the milk breath smell of moss. And she wonders if you feast now on the silent sponge of a dead woman's tongue or splash in the waters God bloodied. She knows your carrion throat, how you sing for what soaks the broken ones, what fills and tears their sodden rainbow bellies. She knows how hunger blunts you, flattens your splintered hackles, and smooths your wing's rough wit. She wants you close and preening, your tail a midnight wedge in the red cliff walls. But she has read the sun's dull tongue and knows the scavenger moon and bruised skylight are the last of your black bell eyes she's going to see. This next poem is called Our Liliths. 6 years tip between my sister and me. 6 years of garnet defeat in our mother's womb. The losses, she says, meant little. The two or three blots of clay and silt. Those hard-to-carry sisters, the Liliths, they still lift their arms in the thick swing-set dark under the arched crabapple. They still spin, anklets jangling, kicking sour leaves up into half-light. Their dark hair rattles with the thumbprints of dirty gold roses. God knows the low songs they sing to the emptied backyard, the scarlet and umber grasses of their refusals. They will not be heard in our own torn garden. They are the better-off daughters who can't care that we stoop to swings to push our children forward, ripe heels rising into the rotting air.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Sally Rosen Kindred, and she's reading from her new book entitled No Eden. Now, these poems can get kind of scary, you know?
Yeah. Well, the poems are really, they're trying to kind of reenter childhood, and childhood's kind of a scary place.
I'm with you there. The one you just read, the dirty gold roses and the jangling anklets in the dark. I like that you're willing to go to those frightening places and not make everything, you know, sweet.
Right. Well, I think that was sort of the challenge of the book, was how to get in there into a kind of mythological space that's real for children. And the Bible was a kind of a way in for me, because we're told those stories as kids, and I'm not sure, you know, how children interpret them when they hear them. But as somebody who the process of writing the book happened as I had my first child. He was named Noah, and I felt a need to kind of account for choosing that name and for what that story had meant to me. Mm-hmm. And the further in I got, the more worried I was about that. But it took a lot of poems to get through there. But
you had said before about the two landscapes in the book,
yes,
the backyards of North Carolina and the biblical landscape. Can you talk about how they started to combine or cross over, or you found some common ground as the book got closer to being itself?
Sure. I think the poem that I just read, Our Liliths, was a really good example of one of the early moments where writing about at first they were rather separate, or I thought they were, but I was asking myself, why do I care about Noah's Ark? And it wasn't just that I had a child named Noah, but why had I named him that? What did it mean to me? And there was something a bit otherworldly about these stories, about a world in which it rains for 40 days and nights, in which there's both a kind of danger and a weird safety. Everybody goes inside and moves together. And that, to me, seemed part of what had felt like the reality of my own backyard as a child. things could happen there that that didn't happen in more orderly parts of the world. And yes, our Lilith is a place where I was thinking about what I felt perhaps haunted by as a child in that yard. And it was easy to imagine parts of our own family drama kind of enacted by biblical characters. And yet the merging just happened in some of the writing and then made clearer to me what the other poems have been about, actually made the process of revision of those poems clearer because I went back to them knowing what my investment was in them.
Was there a moment when you resisted putting them together?
Absolutely. It was a very long moment. I think we wouldn't call it a moment. I would say it was a few months.
Okay.
To me, they seemed like separate collections. Mm-hmm. But I started asking my, you know, people were asking me, why are you writing about Noah's Ark? It was a good question. And as I asked myself about it and wrote my way through it, I couldn't resist it anymore, I guess.
Yeah. Oh, great. Okay, could you read some more?
Sure. This next poem, the book has some poems in it about being at school, and they tend to be rather dark as well. But I'm choosing this one so that because there are also poems about experiencing the outdoors and school in a different way, and this is one of them. This one's about middle school, of all things, speaking of terror, and it's called Earth Science. I loved the Doppler effect for Sam, the black lab whose head shone from the window of the red Ford as Mr. Fenske drove past his pack of students immersed in sun. He drove by with his hand on the horn, which is where Doppler came in, but better was the black flap-eared bliss at the window out of March, better the tongue's swagger in the cracked open air. We were 13, viscous and secreting new warmth, and this was why we were in love with the earth, with its tender mass of panting gratitude, its cool nails ticking on the tiles under the padded weight of an old dog's body, its hope as we'd stood up before tables black with the study of grime and watched the teacher open the dark door into spring. It was early in the evolution of our flesh and damp in that small room. But now we were released, and Sam's tongue hung thick and pink, telling us who we were, not Doppler, who thought he knew how sound gave and withdrew, not sound which wove between our bones in daring cords. We were the dog, our heads poured from the vinyl heart of the dark car, our eyes sopped in sun, tongues dipped in motion sweat. This was the reason we studied the earth, to learn why air, after rain, smells like concrete and skin. To talk about earth so it filled our wet mouths, to let it heat our fine black fur as we hurtled into April, space and time and sun. And the next poem I'm going to read is called American Sweet Gum. By the time I was completing this manuscript, I was reading a lot of field guides. and even that can kind of bring you into memory. So this is sort of about that experience. Here it stands, finally, in the chapter marked Flowering Trees, and I'm afraid to read the words, as if their spiny tongues could curl to touch heartwood, that underbark where the sap no longer goes, as if from the static strip of print my mother could rise, gripping the yard's black bench, and throw her cigarette into the grass and twist her foot over it like a Spanish dancer, and I'd be left sitting under the American sweet gum, my knees pricked by its fruits, bitter spheres, wired as they are with the sweet gums of my children's children, except that I will bear no children. I will lift my small, empty body from this place like those seeds born in dried globes and on flowers nobody remembers anyway. The parched print says nothing of September, that year she left beer for wine, nothing of the safety of the leaves' fingered reds, the fissured wood, crunch of fruit, we called them gumballs, the skate key swinging cold on my neck as I lay in the cracked grass, white Nova pulling up, brother swinging eyes down out its grimy door, father stalking just behind, the racket of birds in the drive wheeling in dust. After all that dense passing, the hoses still twist in dirt, wrong sounds from inside, ants retreating to hills by the asphalt's edge. I killed one there with a flat basketball, looking up then, but not seeing the hair-tender undersides of the lobed leaves, not knowing the bark is stripped, boiled, and pressed to yield a resinous oil. God might or might not be there, in the firm grasp through the cloven air, the whisk of leaves anointed from their start beneath the tree's skin. I didn't ask the trunk and narrow crown how I could pay for what I'd done, and the sweet gum stood, thirsty skin leaning for wind, stood there, not saying my name, not even turning its starry hands.
I think we have time for one more.
Okay. I'll finish up with the title poem from the book. It's called No Eden. Sad pair, God gave you no fine story. Eve walked right past your twilight body, unaware of how her teeth might break into your bristling ashen river, then slip kicking and go under. You hang now over the crumbling lake off Highway 6 through Branchville County, which is no Eden. You listen for falling in some dim field, for angels unbuckling their crimson ladders. You are my lost fruit, my mother's cheek before she taught me hunger. You are her body wobbling in lake light where angels won't throw their garnet ribbons down. Pair of bitter thirst, pair of the beloved lips of dusk. Turn your cheek to me. You are what I remember.
The poetry of Sally Rosen Kindred, reading from her book, No Eden. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Alan Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Wednesday night at 7:30 for Prosody, 91.3 WYEP.